Our second case this morning is 2020-814 Pepper Tree Farms LLC et al. Versus Joy Ann Thonan et al. For the appellant, Ms. Engelwitz.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Emily Engelwitz of the law firm Retzel & Andrus, here on behalf of the appellants, the Jones heirs. Your Honors, this case presents several important issues relating to private property rights, issues that greatly impact Ohio's oil and gas industry. This court should rule in our favor for two reasons. First, the mineral severance and the Jones deed in this case was an exception, not a reservation. And in ruling otherwise, the Fifth District Court of Appeals ignored the clear intent of the parties to the deed and the fact that the grantor was reserving a pre-existing fee oil and gas interest in the land. Second, the filing of the Ward will in 1972 is a title transaction that saves the Jones interest from extinguishment under Ohio's Marketable Title Act, despite the fact that it does not contain a specific devise of the interest or residuary clause, because it influenced title to the Jones interest and put any reasonable title examiner on notice of what happened to the Jones interest upon the death of then-holder Earl S. Ward. For these reasons, we ask this court to reverse the judgment of the Fifth District Court of Appeals and remand the case to the trial court for further proceedings. With respect to our second proposition of law, which is the words of inheritance issue, as a point of contrast to the argument we just heard in the companion Pepper Tree case, this severance involves the fee oil and gas interest as opposed to a royalty. So the operative language in the Jones deed is all the oil and gas underlying the above described premises is hereby reserved and is not made a part of this transfer. And this is, you know, the case law is clear that this is the retainment of a fee interest, not a personal property interest. This is not a royalty. And the severance in the Jones deed is an exception, and that's supported by this court's longstanding precedent in Gill v. Fletcher and Sloan v. Lawrence Furnace. In Sloan, this court instructed that the subject matter of the deed should be examined. And in that case, the subject matter was the minerals underlying the soil. And the court held that this is not a reservation, it's an exception. It's being part of the land described in the deed. So it's not a mere future benefit or interest. It's the minerals underlying the soil. So in that case, it involved the fee interest, just like in this case. Gill, the court, also looked to the fact that the grantor accepted out of the grant and retained in fee simple that which he already had. In that case, it was half the plaster, so it was a mineral interest. So here, just like in Gill and Sloan, Jones was retaining the fee interest in the oil and gas estate in the land, and so that's an exception. To discuss the Buell case, which was discussed a little bit in the prior argument, this court in Buell merely held that mineral estates can be separately owned and separately conveyed. And that does not mean that this is a new future benefit or interest. It's actually part of the pie, as Justice Bruner was saying. It's a component of the greater fee interest. And in this case, it's even more clear because we have the retention of the fee, with a severance of the fee and not just a royalty. This court's decision in Buell actually supports our position, because in that case, this court reaffirmed longstanding precedent that oil and gas is a real estate interest. It's a part of the real property. And so that actually supports our position. To the extent that this court in Gill instructed that we need to look at the facts and circumstances of the deed, that's what we're asking the court to do here. We look to the nature of the interest, the subject matter. You know, this involves the retention of the fee mineral interest, the oil and gas interest. In addition, to the extent this court looks at the language is not made a part of this transfer, just reiterates that point. That's the very definition of an exception. It's an interest that's held back. It's something that's retained. In other words, it's accepted from the grant of the surface estate. Our position is that the Fifth District had a hyper-technical reading of the Jones deed, the majority focusing on the word reserve and nothing else, and not looking at the nature of the interest and the fact that the language, you know, is not made a part of this transfer. We would also note that although that perhaps there's not a technical conflict between the Seventh District Court of Appeals cases and the Fifth District, there's a split in the authority. We cite some cases at page 17 and 18 of our brief from the Seventh District. Our position is that the Seventh District is properly following Gill and Sloan, and we ask the court to reaffirm its decisions in Gill and Sloan and adopt our second proposition of law. Turning to the third proposition of law, which involves the Marketable Title Act. So the Marketable Title Act operates to extinguish interests and claims that are existing prior to the root of title. Here the root of title is a 1957 deed. The MTA exceptions essentially operate as savings events in a way to prevent the extinguishment of interests. In West v. Bode, this court counseled that these exceptions should be used as shields to protect interests from extinguishment and not swords for those claiming marketable title. And from a policy perspective, that makes sense because unlike, for example, in the Dormant Mineral Act, there's no required notice provision in the Marketable Title Act. There's no notice and opportunity to preserve within a specific period of time. It's just automatically extinguished under the operation of the act. But with that as a backdrop, the plain language of the Marketable Title Act demonstrates that the ward will is a title transaction that saved the Jones interest from extinguishment. The statutory definition of title transaction is very broad. It includes any transaction affecting title to any interest, including by will or descent, which is what we have here. The court's case law is clear that it does not have to transfer title. In Buell, the court looked at this title transaction definition that in the context of a DMA case and concluded that limiting the definition of title transaction to those that alter who owns the property would be an overly restrictive reading of the statute. So the court declined to disturb the plain language of the statute in that way. In addition, there's no specific identification requirement. There's nothing that says that the interest has to be specifically identified within the title transaction. The General Assembly used that specific identification language elsewhere in the MTA. That's the subject of the Blackstone and Erickson cases. And if it wanted to use that language here, it could have, and it did not. So the ward will affects title to the Jones interest. And how does it do that? Well, it demonstrates what happened to the interest when when Earl Ward died. So there's no specific devise, there's no residuary clause, but by operation of law in Ohio, it passes under the intestacy statute to Ward's heirs. So that is the title transaction that tells us, as of record, what happened to the interest when Ward died.
I thought the will deeded the land to the daughter, or that the daughter had already gotten the land, I should say.
There is language in there that says he had previously conveyed his real estate interest, I believe it says.
Yes.
The issue with that is twofold. First, there are no transfers in the county land records of this mineral interest. And so had there been, that would have been its own separate title transaction.
But you're saying it's a savings event. Mm-hmm. For one reason, but it's not for the other?
We're saying that, you know, for whatever reason, he mentions the real property and he doesn't actually convey it in that.
He says it's already been conveyed.
He said it's already been conveyed, but that's actually incorrect because there's nothing of record that demonstrates that interest was. And actually, as they outline it in their complaint, the chain of title, they allege, appellees do, that the daughter's inherited, not that it was previously conveyed. So if you look at the way that they traced the title, they knew that when Ward died, his daughter's inherited it. How did they know? We're not sure. They didn't attach the will. But the point is, there's nothing of record. That would have been its own separate title transaction, and that's what we would be looking at had that happened. So because it didn't address it, it didn't actually...
But if it doesn't address it, how is it a savings event for your interest? That's what I'm getting
at. It is, because by default, it passes under intestacy statute. So it is the document that tells us that Earl Ward died. It shows what happened to all of his property. And by operation of Ohio law, what happens when it is not addressed within the will is that it passes to his heirs. So that is something within the mineral chain, and it constitutes an exception under the Marketable Title Act. So the other issue that appellees mentioned is the Jones interest something that is arising out of the 1972 will, and that's something that the court needs to address. Our position is that their proposed definition of arising out of would produce an absurd result. They tell us that you should use the definition begin to occur or exist. But they concede that would mean that the interest could only ever arise out of the severance deed. And that's not what happened here. That's not what happened in the Heifner case, for example. We set forth several alternative definitions in our brief for arising. There's several definitions in Merriam-Webster and Black's that indicate that means come to the attention of. And that makes sense as a definition in the context of the MTA. Under our definition, the Jones interest is an interest arising out of the 1972 will, because anyone searching title would have known what happened to the Jones interest when Ward died seized of that interest. Indeed, Appellee's own recitation of title demonstrates that. It looks like I'm going into my time for rebuttal, so if there are no questions, I'd like to save that time at this point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Matthew Oness, and I represent the appellees in this case. I want to kind of take things out of order here and discuss the marketable title issue first. One thing, I think the Marketable Title Act gets a bad reputation for what it does, but it's generally applicable to real estate, and what it focuses on is the ability to rely on record chain of title. That's the point of it. And I think where the appellants are directing you is somewhere you don't need to go. They're saying, well, it's very harsh. There's no warning like the Dormant Mineral Act. Well, that's not true. In the 1970s, when the General Assembly amended the Marketable Title Act, as this court discussed in the Warner v. Palmer case, and I believe West as well, I apologize if I mix those two. What they said, though, is in the 70s, it was modified and amended to apply to severed minerals for the very first time. And it did not apply the day of enactment. There was a three-year grace period to everybody who would claim severed minerals to take protective actions. This issue in the dormant mineral context went to the U.S. Supreme Court in the Texaco case. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, when you're given a grace period with that type of change, all's good. You have 3 years to protect yourself. If you don't, it's your action and not state action, which causes the extinguishment.
Are you speaking of the Dormant Mineral Act or the Marketable Title Act?
In the Texaco case,
you're talking about the grace period.
The grace period here was the Marketable Title Act did not originally apply to severed mineral rights. It had no applicability. It said doesn't apply.
Right, but there's a grace period also in the dormant.
Correct. Okay. So in the 1970s, when they modified the Marketable Title Act to then apply for the very first time to severed mineral rights, which predate your root, they gave everyone who owned those rights 3 years to take whatever action they needed to preserve, which could be anything, filing a notice of preservation.
Thank you.
As to the will, here's the critical part of that. The statute, the specific statute that we're talking about, is not the definition statute of title transaction. We agree that the definition of title transaction in the marketable title mentions passing by will. We're talking about 5301.49D, subsection D. It says, such record marketable title shall be subject to, subsection D, any interest arising out of a title transaction which has been recorded subsequent to the effective date of the root of title. Okay, so the question is, do the appellee's record marketable title, is it subject to the appellant's interest in these minerals? And through that will, it can't be. They concede the will does nothing to these mineral rights. The will doesn't specifically devise the mineral rights to anybody. It doesn't contain a residue clause which would cause it to pass. And in fact, it says everything real estate that I own, I've given away before. So no, I don't agree with appellant's contention that anybody looking at record chain of title would say, yeah, I know what happened with these mineral rights based on that will, because it doesn't address them at all. And it says they previously were conveyed.
Okay, assume we think you're right about the will. Regardless of what we think of the exception, does that completely end the case?
Absolutely.
So we would just affirm, no remand order, nothing to do here?
Absolutely. Propositions 2 and 3 are alternative. One is it a life estate? I think number 2 is it a life estate? And I think Proposition 3 is the will. If you decide Proposition 3 is no, that the will that doesn't devise it or have residue clauses not qualify for there, this case is over. You never have to get to Proposition number 2 because the Jones interest was extinguished under the Marketable Title Act. You never get to life estate question. And so with the will issue, though, it's akin almost to a deed. You know, a grantor, the particular mineral owner, deeds other property to their son or daughter during that period. But it has nothing to do with the property. Well, that's the same thing as this will. It has no bearing on this particular interest. And that's the critical part about the marketable title I think we all have to keep in mind is, it doesn't pass things out of chain of title. It doesn't do any of that. It tells everyone equally, equal treatment. Rely on record chain of title. Go find your root of deed, at least 40 years old, and then focus on what's in that record chain. Things that predate your root and are not contained within that chain through various exceptions are no longer valid. So we believe that the proposition number 3 should be answered in the negative. This will had no preserving effect. And then that effectively ends the case. As to proposition number 2, this is the life estate issue. I'm not going to belabor all the points that the court just heard in the previous argument. I do want to address a few things that appellant's counsel brought up here. The Headley case is distinguishable from this case because in Headley, the one-half mineral interest at issue was not to be transferred as part of a sheriff's sale. That case involved a sheriff's sale. And it was a foreclosure which led to the sheriff's sale. As part of that trial court order, the trial court said, you don't own the half interest, you cannot convey the half interest. And so it was never part of the grant. It could never be because the trial court never gave the permission to do that. Gill, this court's decision in Gill is also distinguishable from this case for the simple reason that this court did parse the language. Justice Bruner and I talked about parsing the language, and I understand Your Honor's questions about those. But in Gill, this court did, in fact, parse language. This court said, the language said only, quote, only accepted. And this court said, the parties chose that language for a reason. This one is reserved unto Jones and not being part of the transfer. The second portion I get is, we're not ignoring that, but they do say is reserved unto H.J. Jones. And this court in Gill said we have to look at the language and we can't ignore that. They chose that word for a reason. In Sloan, the Sloan case was discussed as well. That is also distinguishable. The reserving language in Sloan was contained in the granting clause. It was from the outset of that deed, that transaction, it told the grantee, you're never getting this, I'm not even conveying it to you. It wasn't a scenario where they conveyed property and then pulled back rights from that property. So that's also distinguishable. The Embleton, or the Embleton case, I will discuss that here briefly. So why that's important is this. So pre-1925, if you conveyed real estate, you had to have words of inheritance in the conveyance as well to not just convey a life estate, and also reservations. So in Embleton, though, there was a conveyance of the property and a reservation of a forfeiture provision. There was a forfeiture in there that said, I get fee simple back. Well, that fee simple interest existed before that transfer. They obviously had all that right. But this court made clear that, listen, we're not talking about just easements and things less than fee. No. Under pre-1925, we're talking about fee simple. So when you reserve back even a condition that would give you fee simple or a portion of fee simple carved out, that can still be a reservation. And that's what we have here. We have the reservation of what amounts to be a fee simple interest in a newly created severed mineral estate. The other thing I want to talk about here is, you know, if we get to this question, which I, talking with Justice DeWine, I don't believe you have to get to this question. But if we get to this question, you know, in the pure oil case, this court said, listen, if we have any doubts about mineral exceptions and reservations, we're concerned about what it is. Is it an exception? Is it a reservation? What are the rights? What are the scope? We're concerned about how we interpret these as a matter of law. Well, what are we going to do with that? And let's say parole evidence, you don't have any of that. What are we going to do? Well, this court said in pure oil that if there's an ambiguity as to what this is, we strongly construe that against the grantor. And the reason we do that is the grantor is in the best position to protect him or herself. He can choose the language. He can do whatever he wants. And so our position on this question is, if there's a doubt as to what this interest did, is it a reservation, is it an exception, because of the mixed language, and we can't determine it from intent, from surrounding circumstances, then we should construe that against H.C. Jones. And the way to construe that against him is, okay, what's the least estate granted? Well, it's a life estate. So he had a life estate. He enjoyed these during his life. He could have produced the minerals. He could have sold them, leased them, but he didn't lose them outright. So our position on all of this, Your Honors, is that we would ask that you answer all the propositions affirmatively. However, our position would be Proposition 3, which is the will question, is a much easier question. I'll give you that. And the statute says my client's marketable title is subject to any interest arising out of that recorded title transaction, and the Jones will has nothing to do with their interest. They don't claim under the will. They've made no claim in this case that they obtained it through the will, for the simple reason that it does not address this and it does not pass it. So,
but the point being made was that even though it wasn't addressed in the will, and that apparently it was determined that it passed anyways, perhaps through the vehicle of intestate succession, what's your comment on the will being the title, an act that would affect the title?
Absolutely. So the Heifner case, this was brought up during the appellants, which goes to your issue. The Heifner case is in appellants counsel argued, well, in Heifner, you guys already agreed that this is can pass by will and the will's enough. That's not true. What you have in Heifner is how these things go.
The will doesn't pass it, and what's being argued by opposing counsel is that it passes through intestate succession. So my question is, the date of the filing of the will, how does that relate to the intestate succession, and do you have an issue with that?
Well, it would have no impact on the intestate succession because the will in and of itself is its own item. It's its own document recorded. The point that I was bringing up with Heifner.
Does the filing of the will affect the title?
No, absolutely not.
Why?
It has no bearing on it because it doesn't devise it and it doesn't have a residue clause. It would be as if, like I said, with the deed, a deed could say, H.G. Jones, so this particular party, I deed this other property to my children, and it would be the same argument. The appellants would say, well, this would tell you who the children were, and that could pass by intestacy. The critical part here is in this court's decision in Heifner with a will. The will was filed. But critically, there were recorded affidavits after that will was filed in conjunction with it showing the transfer of the property. So with intestacy, the question with intestacy is, it says, the statute says.
We're talking about this case and not Heifner, right?
Correct. Okay. Heifner was a will like this, but it had a specific devise, or it may have been a residue, and there were recorded documents to confirm title. Here's the issue with their argument with intestacy. The statute that we're talking about is one portion, 5301.49 subsection D, and it says such record marketable title shall be subject to any interest arising out of a title transaction. If we stop there, maybe we could come up with a scenario where intestacy would be an issue. But it goes on to say which has been recorded subsequent to the effective date of the root of title. The whole point of our recording statutes is to put people on notice and make the record clear. If the General Assembly had intended that intestacy in and of itself, without any document, without anything in the record, intestacy would preserve pre-root interest, then there would be no extinguishment because everyone's going to die eventually.
Thank you. And I guess what I'm getting at is there a way that we relate the filing of the will to the potential for intestacy for something not mentioned in the will? I guess what I'm trying to say is that the will is a title transaction for something that isn't addressed in the will. And is that a problem for you?
Yeah, yes, it is, because the specific statute says, for this exception, any interest arising out of that will. Right, so we'd have to be an interest arising out of the will. Their interest does not arise out of that will. Their interest can't arise out of the will because the will doesn't address the interest, which is why they say, well, it's intestacy. And the will doesn't tell you about intestacy, right? It would just tell you who at the time when they made the will, who were the beneficiaries of the estate. I don't have to pick my surviving spouse. I don't have to pick my children. I can pick whoever I want, right? And it also doesn't tell me that at the time of my death, who are my heirs? Who's going to get the intestacy? So the will has no bearing on intestate succession for interests that are not covered by the will. It would only govern within the four corners of the document.
Would the filing of a death certificate affect that?
I would argue no, because death certificates aren't used or can't be used under anything that I'm aware of to pass title to anything. All they do is they record the date of death and maybe the surviving spouse if there is one, or what you know, there are other ways to do this. So for instance, we have in Ohio what's called an affidavit of heirship, an affidavit of succession by heirship, where you can just record an affidavit as an heir and say, my great-grandfather died and he owned these minerals and here's my family tree. You could record that. You could record a notice of preservation during that time period as well and say, I'm the great-grandson of H.G. Jones. He died with this property and I own it. The only point I would make is that a will itself, which is the single issue here, which does not devise the minerals or have a residue clause, cannot qualify under subsection D because their interest does not and cannot arise from that recorded document.
Thank you.
Counsel, did I understand you correctly when you said you want the props answered affirmatively?
In the negative. I apologize.
You said affirmatively.
And thank you for bringing that up. My brief hopefully said no.
Well,
negative.
Yeah, I'm going through the props and I'm thinking
it would be negative.
What
Your
am
Honor.
I missing?
It would be negative. Right. And where I messed up my language, Your Honor, I apologize, was if we answer Proposition 3 about the will in the negative, that it's not a title transaction on the marketable title, we don't have to ever get to question number 2, the proposition number 2. With that, I would ask that the court affirm the Fifth District's decision. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel, you have about 3.5 minutes left.
Before you get started, I assume you agree that if we answer the proposition and say the will is not a title transaction, that ends the case?
Well, correct. The Fifth District had alternative holdings, so it found that the interest was either terminated for lack of words of inheritance or was extinguished under the Marketable Title Act. So those were alternatives. That's correct.
Okay.
So I have four main points to make on rebuttal. First, to Appley's point about the MTA, it is a harsh remedy. It does act to distribute property from one private person to another, and we're merely asking that the court be mindful of that when it looks at these exceptions, and that it looks at them as shields to protect these interests from extinguishment. Secondly, Appley's argument about the will, this would remove the title transaction's inclusion of title by descent from the definition. Those words were used for a reason, and that's what we have here, title by descent. When the will is filed, even though it doesn't address the interest, it demonstrates what happened by operation of law. Earl Ward, he died testate in this case. He didn't die intestate. So the will becomes a title transaction that demonstrates what happens by operation of law when part of his property is just simply not addressed there. With respect to the Heifner case, that did involve a certificate of transfer, but that is not a requirement. The General Assembly specifically included probate filings in the definition of records, and did not require that they be recorded in the county land records. And so our position is that, again, that's a policy decision that they made, and that under this case, this is what this is. This involves a probate filing and not something that's recorded in the county land records.
And I think you relied on the Erickson v. Morrison case that the title transaction doesn't need to specify the interest, which is why you were saying that the filing of the will would necessarily lead to the passing of the interest in the land, even if not mentioned in the will. Is that what you're saying?
Right. And we referred to the Erickson case. There was language in there that, the court cannot read requirements in a statute that are not there. And the Erickson case involves subsection A of the Marketable Title Act. This is subsection D. But the point being, the court used, or the General Assembly used, the word specific identification in that subsection, but not in this one. And so our point is that, there's nothing in here that says it needs to specifically identify the interest in the title transaction. So that's our position with respect to Erickson. Finally, the Embleton case. That involves a separate agreement for a forfeiture, which is very different from what we have. Feel that that's distinguishable. Finally, I would just note that this is the only case that we've found, this Fifth District case, where that held that the retention of a fee interest by the grantor is a reservation. So in summary, the mineral severance in the Jones deed was an exception, not a reservation. It's retention of a pre-existing interest in the land. The filing of the Ward will is a title transaction that saves the interest from extinguishment. We would ask this court to reverse the judgment of the Fifth District Court of Appeals, remand the case to the trial court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.